It's Wednesday, July 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton cleared of email charges, but the dispute continues. U.S. financial markets search for a direction after Brexit.
What a feeling. A mission of this complexity to accomplish tonight is just truly amazing.
A space probe makes a difficult entry into Jupiter's orbit. Also ahead, textbooks that students want to read. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation says it is recommending no criminal charges be brought against Hillary Clinton for her use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State, lifting a major political and legal hurdle for the presumptive Democratic presidential candidate. But the decision doesn't necessarily mean the controversy has ended. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us from Capitol Hill with more.
Jim, FBI Director James Comey came in front of the cameras and said that the FBI has concluded after an exhaustive investigation stretching over a year that Hillary Clinton, the Democratic presidential nominee-to-be, was grossly negligent in her handling of emails, that the FBI cannot be sure that some emails and some classified information did not fall into the hands of America's enemies. However, that gross negligence does not equal criminality, and that there is no evidence of intent to commit a crime, and that the gross negligence itself does not constitute a crime in and of itself. So it was clearing Hillary Clinton as a matter of the court of law. But of course, we are in a presidential election cycle, and there is also the court of public opinion, and that has yet to weigh in.
And gross negligence will not sit well, of course, with the Republicans who are opposing Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump specifically.
Absolutely. Donald Trump took to Twitter, as he often does. This was his quote. FBI director said, "Crooked Hillary compromised our national security. No charges. Wow. Hashtag rigged system." Other tweets that came out from prominent Republicans, Rand Paul, a senator from Kentucky, said that Obama's Department of Justice has made it clear to the American people that there's no accountability, no justice, and the Clintons live by different rules. Jim, I would just mention that, you know, I don't have any sound effects here in my studio at the Senate. But if I did, for the Democrats, I would play sound effects of crickets chirping. Because literally, the Democrats, at least the Senate Democrats that I follow, are saying nothing. They are tweeting today about the 4th of July parades that they attended yesterday in their constituent meetings, but they are very definitely not tweeting about this statement from the FBI.
It gives you a sense of the sensitivity of the issue, and it will remain throughout the November election as voters decide whether gross negligence is something that they can live with in a president or not.
Absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing. Hillary Clinton has been campaigning with a message here. She acknowledges that she's not the most inspiring speaker, but what she says is that she is the person of competence. She is the wise technocrat who can guide the nation through troubled waters. And I would suspect that when you have the director of the FBI saying that she had an email system that she maintained in her own house in violation of State Department rules, even though it doesn't add up to criminality, it very much undercuts Hillary Clinton's message of being the sort of wise technocrat who can competently lead the nation. And that's, I suspect that that's something that will be weighing in voters' minds as we head towards November.
Hillary Clinton may describe herself as not an inspiring speaker, but we are always inspired by your great information from Capitol Hill. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
We stay now with our top story for our next segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me right here in Studio 22 to tell us what people are saying about the Democratic presidential campaign that just wrapped up in Charlotte. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. It was the first time President Obama is joining former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on her campaign trail. And as many of our listeners already know, she's the presumptive Democratic nominee. Clinton's intro and Mr. Obama's speech were both streamed live on her Facebook page and her campaign website. It was captioned as, "Live from Charlotte, President Obama hits the trail with Hillary for the first time in this campaign." During the peak of the event, more than 17,000 people tuned in.
That's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she is known to run a very savvy team of social media managers, so mm-hmm. I expect they were live tweeting the event, right?
You bet. They were live tweeting even before the event began. The Democratic duo was going hard against Donald Trump, even mentioning him by name in their speeches. And here's an example. When introducing President Obama, Clinton said he is someone who has never forgotten where he came from. And Donald, if you're out there tweeting, it's Hawaii. Her team tweeted that remark.
Well, how about some reactions? Any from POTUS or Donald Trump?
Neither of them tweeted about it yet, but I am quite sure Trump will tweet something about it since he was mentioned more than a couple of times. And of course, as you know, he's quite prolific on mm-hmm. Twitter. Before the president's speech, he sent out two tweets about his rival, and specifically he was tweeting about FBI Director James Comey's recommendation on her email investigation. Comey recommended no charges, as we just heard from Michael, and Trump even created a new hashtag. Guess what it's called? Hashtag rigged system.
Of course.
He argued Comey's recommendation is very unfair and reflective of a bad judgment. I also want to add that Mr. President is taking over Clinton's Instagram account for the time that they're in Charlotte. So that's going to be something interesting to keep look forward to. That's all for me today, Jim.
All very interesting. Thanks for that wrap-up, G. You may tweet us your comments and questions to our Twitter stream. It's at @VOA_IE. And you'll find myself and G on Twitter at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia at this hour, China launches military drills before tribunal ruling. Deep sorrow in Japan as Bangladesh attack victims return home. Indian Prime Minister seeks to consolidate ties with Africa. Cambodia labor leaders speak out against union law. Groups train young to battle corruption in Cambodia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and, if you have a smartphone, on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. financial markets took a break for the 4th of July holiday. They've had some time to cool following last week's dramatic recovery from Britain's surprise Brexit vote. To find out what they're doing, we consult with VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino from New York.
Yeah, all three major averages in the U.S. are taking a bit of a beating today. And that's essentially what we saw happen with global markets overnight as well, with a sell-off. A part of the reason is it's unlikely that we're going to get any real clarity on the big issue surrounding Brexit for quite some time. And there was also soft Chinese data that was released on the overnight. What we're seeing in turn, though, government bonds have rallied across the globe, and they're continued to set record low yields on increasing expectations of further global central bank easing. Now, it will be interesting, speaking of central banks, the Federal Reserve is going to release its minutes from the June meeting last month, and we saw that there was no change in interest rate policy and that they were more dovish than ever. The expectation right now in the market is we won't see an interest rate hike until at least February 2018, but we will see some tradable action off of this. Anytime you get FOMC or Fed-related headlines hitting the tape, traders will trade that action, so we will see some volatility around 2 o'clock on Wednesday. Other than that, there's not much economic data to speak of this week, except for international trade and, of course, the all-important employment situation report on Friday. That's going to be another key data point because it was so disappointing last month in June. So analysts are looking for roughly 200,000 jobs to have been created versus the dismal 38,000 that we saw in June. earnings continue to be very quiet. We won't see an uptick in that till Alcoa kicks off the official start on July 11th. Two S&P names reporting this week that we should be aware of are Walgreens and Pepsi. But for right now, the focus is going to be on macro concerns with China, Brexit, and the Fed on Wednesday.
Well, if nothing more, Brexit showed that the U.S. economy is fairly steady, at least with that bounce back. And the Fed was trying to raise rates at least to get a little bit of wiggle room there in case there was another big downturn. How will the Fed react to this?
I think the Fed is not going to do anything for 2016. There is a lot of uncertainty right now. We saw how volatile markets can get just on that surprise Brexit vote. So I think Janet Yellen and company are going to keep it relatively stable. That's why I'm curious to see what the minutes say on Wednesday. And then, of course, we have another FOMC meeting this month. So the volatility isn't over quite yet. And I think this is something that we'll see at least going through our elections here.
And the concern for the European banks, I'm sure that remains out there.
It certainly does remain out there. Deutsche Bank is probably, of all the banks, the one that's in the most precarious position. But right now in the U.S., the majority of the banks passed their stress test. And I think that's why we're going to see more bullish action in U.S. markets, because we really are the most stable market out there relative to Europe emerging markets. So I think stocks like a Ford or GM or anything in the utility or telecom sector will continue to do well, because since bonds aren't paying anything, in fact, you're paying some places to hold their bonds. You're going to see the high yield dividend producer stocks continue to do well.
No question. The stability of our information comes out of New York with Jill Malandrino. Jill, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
The U.S. space agency NASA and a team of scientists and engineers on Tuesday successfully placed the Juno spacecraft in an elliptical orbit around the solar system's largest planet, Jupiter. It caps a five-year, 2.8 billion kilometer voyage from Earth. Juno will take the next 20 months to study the planet, with scientists hoping to learn more about its formation and that of the rest of the solar system. The team was ecstatic, as you might expect, after learning that Juno's main engine fired as intended. It slowed it from speeds approaching 260,000 kilometers per hour, so it could enter an orbit that would bring it to within just 5,000 kilometers above Jupiter's clouds while avoiding its hazardous radiation belts. Speaking at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, in turn after a post-engine burn news briefing, are NASA's Jeff Yoder and Diane Brown, followed by principal scientist Scott Bolton of the Southwest Research Institute.
What a feeling. A mission of this complexity to accomplish tonight is just truly amazing. And it really highlights the partnership and the teamwork between NASA and our contractors and our partners to be able to achieve this amazing, amazing mission. Let me turn this over now to Diane Brown.
I was asked to talk about what it feels like to have this success, and it's just, I mean, it's overwhelming. The amount of time and effort everyone put into this and the risks that were overcome, it's amazing. I mean, the more you know about the mission, you know just how tricky this was, and to have it be flawless. I mean, I really can't put it into words. You imagine what it might feel like, but to actually have it, to know that we can all go to bed tonight not worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow, it's pretty awesome. So that's really all I can say. It's just amazing. So, Scott, how do you feel?
NASA did it again. That says it all to me. And I am so happy to be part of the team that did that. I mean... This team has worked so hard, and we have just such great people. And it's just it's almost like a dream coming true right here.
Morris Jones is an independent space analyst based in Australia, and he tells our own Victor Beatty that Juno is not the first space probe of Jupiter. Galileo circled the planet for 8 years, beginning in 1995.
Despite the fact that Jupiter has been visited by so many probes in the past, there are still a lot of unanswered questions and areas on the planet that haven't been even approached by any particular space probe.
This is a mission that is fraught with a lot of risks.
I'd say that the greatest risk of all is radiation. Jupiter looks very tranquil in photographs, but what you can't see are the massive radiation belts that are so strong that they'd probably kill any astronauts who went there. So we'll probably never send astronauts this close to the planet. And in fact, most robot space probes would be fried in terms of their electronics if they even got this close. And for that reason, the Juno probe has a lot of radiation protection on board.
There was one other spacecraft sent around Jupiter earlier called the Galileo. What's the difference between Juno and Galileo?
Galileo was like a very broad survey of Jupiter and its moons. It was a very long mission, and it had a lot of instruments and a lot of different scientific goals. The Juno mission that's about to arrive is focused on a smaller set of questions, but it's all about finding out answers to some of the questions that the Galileo space probe could not answer. And one way that it's doing that is that it's going to in a very different orbit. Galileo was orbiting fairly close to Jupiter's equator, whereas the Juno probe will be practically going pole to pole, roughly 90 degrees to the sort of orbit that Galileo used.
Scientists are hoping during this mission to determine whether or not there is water on Jupiter. What significance would that hold?
Water is part of the whole mass balance of the solar system, and the more water that Jupiter soaks up, the less water there is for other planets. And so this gets back to one of the big questions that Juno's trying to answer. What went into Jupiter didn't go into any of the other planets, and so it's a case of looking at just what happened to the solar system as a whole. And Jupiter is very significant given the fact that it's the largest planet and it weighs more than the rest of the solar system put together, except for the sun, of course.
This was a long mission. This spacecraft was launched 5 years ago.
Jupiter is right in the middle of the solar system. It takes a long time to get there because of the angles of the planets, and also because if you want to go there quickly, you would have to burn more fuel. Now, it wasn't really critical to rush to Jupiter quickly because, I mean, there were no astronauts on board, so they took a fuel-efficient trajectory that took longer but meant that they could save money with a smaller rocket.
Juno's computers and science instruments are encased in a 180-kilogram vault for protection from radiation as the spacecraft begins its 37 orbits around Jupiter before being allowed to crash onto the surface in the year 2018. You can visit voanews.com for much more on this story, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Every school year, students must slog through thick and often boring textbooks. Their bulk and format can disguise the fact that there's actually often a lot of great stuff between the covers. Well, to make sure that students are getting the great stuff, a former reporter is putting some zing into history and science. From Denver, Shelley Schlender reports.
If you're a newly freed slave, good or bad?
This history class at Grayland Country Day School in Denver is discussing the U.S. Civil War. A seventh grader calls their main study guide a great read.
It's a page turner for sure. You don't realize how much you're actually learning when you read it because it keeps you engaged.
That page turner is a textbook titled The History of Us.
It makes me actually want to keep reading instead of saying, oh my gosh, this is over, thank God, as I do in other textbooks.
Let me tell you how I got started. So I was a reporter.
That's Joy Hakem, the book's author, explaining to this history class how three decades ago, a newspaper asked her to cover a meeting about the poor quality of school textbooks.
Anyway, I left that meeting, you know, astonished by what I had seen. And I thought, oh, I can take a year and write a U.S. history. No big deal. So it took, as we say, It took 10 years from the time I started until I actually had a book in hand. And I expected it to be one book. Never occurred to me that it would end up 10 books.
For her history book series, Haycombe avoided a typical publishing protocol, which calls for a committee of writers to collaborate. She decided her books would have a greater impact if she was the one and only author.
When you think of the books that you like, the literary books, it's an author talking to the reader, especially somebody who has some passion, and I really care about what I'm writing.
To edit her books, Haycombe recruited world-class subject experts, plus a highly specialized team.
I paid children to be my editors. I told them they were being my editors, and then I gave them a code. So when you read this manuscript, put in the margin, B for boring. You know, every kid knows boring. G for good, NC for not clear. And tell me anything you want to tell me.
Most importantly, Haycombe says she focused on the time-honored tradition of explaining through stories. Haycombe's history books have now sold millions of copies and have been honored with Teacher and Parents' Choice Awards. So have her science books. Haycombe is writing a new series about evolution and biology. She says it's challenging to find publishers for the alternative textbooks she writes, but she'll keep trying for the sake of children and stories that help people think. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Denver.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. That's our website. Like us on Facebook while you're online. VOA Now is the place to go. And follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dan Crafton. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We thank you so much for taking part of your day to be with us. Come back when you can, and we hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Colombian government and leader of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, agreed to a bilateral ceasefire pact on June 23rd, paving the way for a final peace deal that would end the 52-year civil conflict. This war has taken the lives of an estimated 220,000 people and forced nearly 7 million Colombians from their homes. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry welcomed the news. "I am pleased that after more than 4 years of intensive talks, the Colombian government and the FARC have achieved breakthroughs on some of the most challenging issues before them. Although hard work remains to be done, the finish line is approaching and nearer now than it has ever been." Under the terms of the agreement, the rebels will gather in 23 protected zones and 8 camps, where they will disarm in phases after a final accord is reached. Colombian government forces will provide security, and United Nations observers will be present in the camps to oversee the process and mediate disputes. For many years, and on a bipartisan basis, the United States has supported Colombia in its efforts to strengthen its democracy and safeguard the security of its people. That friendship will continue as Colombia's leaders strive to complete the peace process and take steps to recover from the many years of division and conflict. To this end, the United States will work closely with Colombia to ensure that commitments made during negotiations yield tangible benefits for the country's citizens. In February, President Obama announced Paz Colombia, a new strategic framework for its bilateral engagement. As part of that plan, the United States, along with Norway, is leading a global demining initiative for Colombia. The United States congratulates all Colombians as they take the final steps towards a just and lasting peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.